is underwritten in part by a grant from Champagne Cycle, offering equipment, information, and experience to help the active cyclist of any age enjoy the fun of cycling. Champagne Cycle, 506 South Country Fair Drive, just south of Springfield Avenue in Champaign. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Learn about Krannert Center's 2004-2005 performance season with guest artists Dan Zanes, Scottish fiddler Bonnie Rideout, and hip-hop dance artist Rennie Harris by visiting KrannertCenter.com or stopping by to pick up a season brochure.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. We're also happy to have with us again Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's professor at the U of I Med School, clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology. She also has practice here in our area and also once a month is here on the program, always on a Monday, to talk about women's health. She comes prepared with some things that are new that she thinks that you might be interested in hearing about, so we could talk about that. But also, the idea is that if you have questions, you can call in and talk about your concerns with the doctor. Whenever we have physicians on the program, I always try to remind people right up front that there are some limits on what we can do in this format. After all, we can't do diagnosis over the phone. However, we do these programs to try to add to your store of knowledge, give you a place to start. So if you'd like to talk with the doctor, you certainly give us a call, and then of course, if you have concerns, you need to take that up with your own physician or someone who can see you. Questions here are welcome, though, 333-9455. And that's for Champaign Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Well, I know that you have a number of things that you can talk
about.
There's
been a lot in the news. Usually summer gets sleepy, all those researchers go off and rest, but there's actually been a lot in the news. I thought I would start by talking about some of the screening tests for birth defects that we use, and the one that's most often talked about is what used to be called the alpha-fetoprotein test, and now we call it a quad screen or a triple screen. And this is a blood test done on the mother at about 16 to 18 weeks of pregnancy, and the blood test tests for alpha-fetoprotein, which is a carrier protein in moms. It tests for the estriol, which is the placental estrogen, and it tests for the human chorionic gonadotropin, which is the another hormone that is made by the placenta itself, and that's called a triple screen, and what we have nicknamed a quad screen also includes inhibin. And the addition of the inhibin very, very slightly improves the statistical prediction rate of these tests. And in our community here, about half the doctors use the triple and about half the quad. The quad screen is a little bit more expensive test. And what happens is that the test report tends to report out that it's either low, normal, or high for the alpha-fetoprotein component, and the other components are used in a statistical model to predict certain birth defects. So that with high level of alpha-fetoprotein, it is more likely that you are carrying a baby with a neural tube defect like spina bifida, which we've talked about. A low level is a little bit more likely that you are carrying a baby with Down syndrome. And if it's normal, it doesn't assure us that the baby is normal, but it's a very good sign. And rather than using, say, a cutoff of a woman's age at which to screen for birth defects like Down syndrome, we currently recommend that you get an ultrasound and that you get the blood testing, either the triple or the quad screen, and then based on those two tests, triage out those individuals that may need further tests. And what ends up happening in actually the majority of cases, it's the best prediction we have, but what does tend to happen in the majority of cases, the test indicates that there's no actual birth defect in the baby. Now, the patients who have no birth defect that's picked up, number one, we could have still missed a birth defect. Number two, it's more likely that that pregnancy is going to be more high risk for some reason or another. Either the placenta is separating, the mom is going to be at risk for diabetes, premature labor, hypertension, something. So we do like to watch those pregnancies a little bit more closely. But a very interesting study has just come out to help us understand why perhaps some moms with perfectly normal pregnancies actually show up abnormal on this test. And it turns out that some researchers in Taiwan thought that they were getting more false positive tests for Down syndrome in vegetarians. And the only thing they could link it to in their research was that vegetarians tend to be lower in vitamin B12 level. Now, that's one of those news reports that it is so interesting, and I think that it does help us sometimes explain to moms what might possibly be going on, because very often we don't have an explanation. I think it's probably going to be something that's going to have to be worked out by additional research groups before we can really apply and maybe have a recommendation to do blood testing for B12 levels, that sort of thing. But B12 is something that vegetarians tend to be a little bit lower in, and making sure that they get adequate levels of B12, probably in most cases through supplementation, is probably going to be important for their pregnancy health.
Is there anything else that any other particular reason why you would say if a woman was a vegetarian and she was pregnant that she should be thinking about making sure that sure that she gets everything she needs?
Anemia has definitely been an issue overall, and B12 anemia would be one type in that category, because much of the iron that many women get is from meats, particularly red meats, and some of the iron that is available in vegetable products like spinach is not very bioavailable. So even if you eat the spinach, it does have iron in it, and you may get a little of it, but it's not particularly bioavailable. So you really have to do that with supplementation. Beyond that, many vegetarians are so conscious that they have to fulfill certain nutrient groups by thinking about it and planning their meals. I think in general, we've demonstrated that for the most part, their diet is quite healthy. And again, it may vary if they're true vegans. There may be some amino acids that they may not be able to cover as well. And I think research still needs to be done in terms of some of these micronutrient deficiencies that may not be completely obvious yet.
We have a caller here, someone to talk with in Bloomington. Let's do that. Line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I had a question regarding vaginal dryness, and I was wondering if you could comment on different options for treatment for that.
Okay. So are you saying that you have been to a healthcare provider and you have no actual ongoing infection? It's just a chronic problem of vaginal dryness?
Yes.
Okay, is this in a person who is, say, under the age of 40 or over the age of 40?
Over
the age of 40.
And postmenopausal.
Okay. Postmenopausal. Okay. In general, we think that the vaginal wall is kept moist by a process called transudation, and that means that water passes through the lining tissue of the vagina, and in order for that whole physiology to be set up well, certain kinds of things in our physiology need to be happening, and one of it is a very good vascular network just beneath the surface of the lining tissue of the vagina. And that vascular network is very well supplied when we're younger, but as we get older and estrogen deficient, that vascular network tends to go away, and the lining itself undergoes direct changes so that we don't have the top layers any longer of that tissue that lines the vagina, but we tend to be down to what's called basal layer. And the basal layer tends to be very thin, and so it can be disrupted. So the vaginal dryness can be, number one, due to hormones. Number two, produce an uncomfortable sensation. Number three, not allow the same kinds of physiology that the vaginal environment had prior to menopause, so that women can be a little bit more susceptible to picking up infections such as yeast infections. And lastly, during intercourse, women, even with proper arousal, do not get the same amount of discharge. So that we think that ultimately most of these problems are due to lack of estrogen. So people have two different choices. One, you can try to treat it non-hormonally with some of the products like Replenz, which is a non-hormonal moisture supplement that's available over the counter. You can try just with intercourse to use lubricants that do help just with the temporary lubrication during intercourse. And then finally, the best treatments tend to be local use of vaginal estrogen. And we have shown that if you give very small doses in the vagina, that no actual blood levels of estrogen exist. And it's therefore extremely safe, even for women who have reasons not to be on hormone supplement pills or who don't want to be on hormone supplement pills. But the use of estrogen tends to be an important component of treating this condition.
How is that applied?
Well, most of the estrogens that are used vaginally come in a cream form that's applied with an applicator. There is also a small pill that can be inserted with an applicator that contains estrogen. And now there are also vaginal rings that can be worn. There's one ring that's designed to be worn for 3 months that leaks a little estrogen locally. So it can be applied a variety of ways.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. This is our monthly program on women's health, and our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. And we do this every month to give you an opportunity to ask questions, anything that she deals with in her practice. I'm sure she'd be happy to do her best to give you an answer. And again, locally, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. What, just to stay with that topic for a second here, what sort of, I would imagine if you have a woman who's got a family history of cancers, you know, particularly ovarian cancers or anything that affects the reproductive tract, that might be a contraindication. Is that the case?
When the FDA convenes its panels and looks at these questions, we really haven't ever come up with a firm guideline that, based on family history alone, that anybody is too risky for hormonal supplementation in menopause. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, we know that long-term use of hormone supplements can increase your risk of breast cancer. But the increases are small. We say that we look at about one extra breast cancer per 1,000 women per year in estrogen users, even in people with a family history. So I don't think that there's really any specific group that should be looked at as too high for temporary use of estrogen. And even with the vaginal estrogen that I was speaking about a moment ago, we use that treatment in breast cancer patients. And it has been deemed as safe because it's such a low level of hormone and it does not get systemic blood levels. So even if there was that small theoretical possibility that small levels of estrogen would slightly increase your risk or increase your risk of a recurrence if you had previously been treated for breast cancer, the chance is virtually eliminated by using such small local doses.
Mm-hmm. And if you started on this course of treatment, then is this something that you would do every day? And then would you have to, as long as you wanted to have the effects of the hormone, do you have to continue to use the treatment?
Well, you do have to continue to use the treatment or the treatment effects go away. But most women do not have to use the medicine every day. What typically is recommended is daily use for a couple of weeks to kind of get things going and get the problem behind the patient. And then after that, probably using estrogen once a week in postmenopause over long periods of time seems to be an excellent balance between a little bit of extra estrogen and virtually no blood level exposure to estrogen. So it's very safe.
But again, going back to what you said, because the effect is localized. If you're interested in other kinds of things, prevention of osteoporosis or
Correct.
Whatever the other things that we associate with supplementing estrogen, that's not going to do anything.
No, it's not. And the flip side is if you happen to be a patient who needs daily vaginal estrogen for more than 2 weeks on an ongoing basis in order to treat a condition like vaginal dryness, then you are probably now getting systemic blood levels and you have to be evaluated and treated like a patient who is getting systemic blood levels. And this is something that we didn't see that much of 5 years ago, say, but now in the past couple, 3 years that people have come off of hormones because of the information in the Women's Health Initiative study conducted by the National Institute of Health, women are coming off systemic hormones, but now finding themselves faced with this vaginal dryness, going on vaginal hormones. But I'm gradually seeing bigger groups of women who are coming in saying, you know, I feel really well on this vaginal estrogen. And on closer discussions, we're realizing that they're using it so much, they're getting systemic levels. So you have to understand it may be safe and it may be appropriate, but you do need to communicate that with your healthcare provider so that you can get the accurate information. And if you're really using that much estrogen and you do have a uterus, you may still need some progesterone to balance off the effects of estrogen on the lining of the uterus.
Okay.
But that's kind of where we're going with menopausal therapy. We're trying to think about the new results from the Women's Health Initiative study and trying to best apply all that information to patients so that, for instance, of women who have discontinued estrogen, there's a big question mark out there as to what is now going to be the best way to preserve your bone health. And the first order of business is to find out what your bone health is after you've gone off the medicine, because the effects of estrogen will start wearing away after 3 months. And after 6 months to a year, virtually all the effects on your bone from that estrogen supplementation are gone. So you may have good bones when you got them tested when you were on hormone therapy, but if you got them tested a year later, your bones may not be so good. Also, we're reevaluating the types of estrogen. We're reevaluating the doses of estrogen. And in the United States, research takes a while to answer these questions. There were two very interesting reports in the past week or two about hormone therapy. And one was that in actuality, a hormone therapy combination that had estradiol, a bioequivalent estrogen that is available in the United States, and drospirenone, which is the type of progesterone in the birth control pill Yasmin. And it had the same amount of progesterone as in the birth control pill Yasmin, but about three times the estrogen dose, I think. I didn't memorize that. I didn't write down the dose with me. But in those postmenopausal patients taking that type of hormone supplementation, their blood pressure significantly improved, which is really fascinating because on other combinations, that has not been seen. And we think that maybe some of the increased breast cancer risk seen in the combination therapy that they took in the Women's Health Initiative may have been due to that type of progesterone. So trying to either figure out how you could give women the estrogen without the progesterone or with much less progesterone or possibly a different type of progesterone and possibly not only eliminate the increased risk in breast cancer but maybe turn that around. So possibly estrogen combination with drugs like CERMs, these selective estrogen receptor modulators like the drug raloxifene, which we've talked about, that can potentially reduce your breast cancer rate. So these are the kinds of things that have interested menopausal researchers across the country, and I'm also participating in a couple of studies looking at some of these aspects of hormone therapy.
Well, I want to make sure people who are listening know that we're open for questions. If you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Trubin, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have that toll-free line. So that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. We'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. Well, what else would you like to talk about?
Well, I was going to mention one other thing about anemia that was also in the news. It's not as much directly in my field, but it was in the area of nutrition for women. And these particular researchers were interested in the issue of fatigue and exercising and fitness from the exercise that women do. And they were specifically looking at the fact that if you are anemic, that it's very difficult to get proper conditioning from the exercise that you do. And many people do not know that they're anemic, but young women who have heavy menstrual periods are in the group that's very likely to be anemic. And so in an attempt to produce exercise benefits to groups of women, they were trying to use iron supplementation. And it turns out that it's not just what your blood count shows. Definitely iron supplementation in people who had both low blood counts and low tissue levels of iron were helped incredibly and were able to train better and exercise better and have much more energy. But it was interesting, they've now identified a group of women who actually had a fairly normal blood count, but with very sophisticated testing, they were able to show that they had low tissue levels of iron. And in these people, iron supplementation helped. But in groups of women who had some blood testing that showed anemia, but not low tissue levels of anemia, they weren't helped by the supplementation. Excuse me. So this is a fascinating new area of research. So I think the take-home message is that if you seem to be additionally fatigued, if you are embarking on a new exercise program, which a lot of people do this time of year, and you're not seeming to be able to build up in your endurance and your fitness level, look into anemia as a possible cause.
We have some other callers. So let's talk with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm calling on behalf of my mother, who's she's 57. She's been taking Fosamax for a year, and she recently went in and had another bone density test done, and her her hip, I think it was, slightly improved, but I believe it was the back is where they take the other regimen. Actually got worse, and she's moving now into a level that they consider to be osteoporosis. And her doctor suggested that she take another drug in combination with the Fosamax. And I'm, at the moment, I can't remember the name of that drug, but I know that one of the side effects my mother was concerned about was an increase in blood clots, the risk of blood clots. And so I was wondering if you know anything about treatments that my mother could look into at this point in her treatment, since the Fosamax doesn't seem to be working on its own.
Okay. Of course, we always remind people we can't diagnose and treat an individual case.
Right.
But let's talk about some of the general issues. Mm-hmm. It sounds like from your mother's initial evaluation that she had what was called osteopenia, so a low bone mass, mm-hmm. that was being treated by a bisphosphonate, which is designed to help prevent fractures and has been shown in studies to also in some groups of patients increase their bone density, and I'll get back to that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
And she's now been on it for a while and had another test. And for most patients, when to do that next test is, excuse me, is a little bit controversial in that some doctors do a test very quickly within 6 months of starting a patient on medication, and some physicians believe in waiting a couple of years, and actually either of those can be reasonable. Now, the ultimate goal of osteoporosis treatment is a couple of different things. Number one is to prevent fractures.
Mm-hmm.
That is our ultimate goal. Number two is really what we think of as a surrogate marker for fracture prevention. And that is a complicated mumbo-jumbo way of saying that the lower your bone mass is, ultimately, the more likely you are to fracture. So that our goal is to improve the patients as much as possible. Now, we think that getting a fracture involves many different factors. It's not only the thickness of your bone, it's the overall health of your bone. It's not only whether you fall, but the type of fall. And so that women at the age of 57 who have osteopenia are really not at a very big risk of fracturing. They're only at about a double the age-related risk of fracturing, but your age-related risk of falling and breaking your hips, very, very low. So that rate isn't very great. As they move even into osteoporosis at that age, regardless of treatment, they increase their fracture risk by about 6 to 10%. But again, you're multiplying a very low number, even by as much as 10 times, you still have a low risk of a fracture, as most hip fractures will occur in women in their late 60s, 70s, 80s.
Okay.
We know that most of bone strength is related to this thickness. About 75% is related to thickness. So we put a lot of store in these measurements. But not all bone quality is related to the thickness of bone. And just like not everybody with high cholesterol has a heart attack and not everybody who has a heart attack has high cholesterol, same with hip fractures. These bone measurements, you can only infer just so much for them. We know that women in menopause tend to lose a couple of percent per year of their bone, and fast losers can lose 6 to 8% of bone in short periods of time. And one thing that doesn't pertain to your mother's case, but that I was referring to, is it looks like people who have newly come off their estrogen go into a very fast loss process. And this is very concerning, and we need to look into this a little bit further. But at any rate, so if you do a research study and you put groups of women on medicines like bisphosphonates, Vosamax is one, and Actonel is one, or any of the other treatments, and one might be raloxifene, which does increase your risk of clots slightly to in the same order as estrogen, and another treatment, of course, is estrogen. And I'll get back to the raloxifene in a second. If you put groups of patients on this, many patients, in fact most, will slightly increase their bone density. Many will stay the same, and a small percentage will lose. But across the board, the fracture rate is lowered. So just because the number is not improving does not necessarily mean that your mom is not protected at least to some extent against a fracture. Now, you know, we get in a car accident or we get a big enough trauma, or anybody would fracture, of course, it's not quite the same. As we think about what to do with the so-called non-responders, there's a little bit of controversy here, and it is not unreasonable to piggyback medicines, but there are many experts who don't advise it. They might advise switching medicines over to some other treatment. They might advise changing dose. And there are some new treatments out that are eventually going to be used more, like there's parathyroid hormone treatment, which may or may not be indicated. But right now, parathyroid treatment actually is designed to increase the amount of bone added. But both bisphosphonates and the raloxifene, which I think your mom had recommended, I'm not sure, but also in the third place, estrogen. All three of those treatments do approximately the same thing for bone in that they slow the bone turnover down. And so we have natural way of replenishing our bone by wearing away small areas and redepositing calcium. And what happens to increase the thickness is it's a trigger that not as much bone is worn away as is deposited, so that the balance is shifted a little bit, if you can follow that. Mm-hmm. I do this much better with a blackboard than I do over the radio. But so if both of those things have that same mechanism, there's a question mark in our minds as to, is this really healthy to slow the bone down that much for a long period of time? The second thing is that you get two drugs, you get two sets of complications, and can you show that there's increase in density? Yes, that's been shown in a couple of studies. But can you show that you're, by increasing this density, you're also decreasing your fracture risk? And no, that part has not yet been studied. Now, you have to understand that, again, 57-year-old's not very likely to fracture. So you have to study these people for long periods of time to show fracture prevention. So the first thing we look at is, well, does this work at all in anybody to increase the numbers? So I myself have some patients on double medicines, but I tend to be in the camp of researchers who recommends to think twice about that. And I look at other things, vitamin D levels, other potential causes of osteoporosis, look a little more carefully at the type of calcium and the amount of calcium and the calcium blood levels. I like to also look at urine tests that are markers of bone turnover. If they show that the bone turnover is very high, then I think in terms of either switching drugs or possibly then if the drug switching didn't help, adding medication together. And with those kinds of things done prior to switching, also endocrinologists tend to study the subject fairly closely, and it tends to be endocrinologists that recommend medicines like parathyroid hormone. So sometimes it's a good idea to get an individual opinion.
So what is the parathyroid treatment? And I know, what is this have to do with the thyroid gland? Because I know she does have some problems with that.
It's completely different than the thyroid gland, and it just so happens that these little glands exist to the side in our body. They exist to the side of the thyroid.
Okay.
So they got nicknamed the parathyroid gland, but they have nothing to do with the thyroid itself.
Okay.
And the drug raloxifene that I was referring to is a SERM, a selective estrogen receptor modulator, and it was what I was talking about before. It's very estrogen-like on some tissue, in other words, the bone, and it's anti-estrogen on other tissues, so it can help prevent breast cancers. And the drug raloxifene is approved for the prevention and treatment of osteoporosis, and it's being studied in the STAR trial for prevention of breast cancer, which is kind of interesting.
Hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much for the information.
Very good. We'll just go on here, and I think our next caller is on our toll-free line in Hidalgo, and that is line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering about side effects from tamoxifen. I had breast cancer 2 years in August, and they took me off of the tamoxifen on account of the side effects, and they put me on Armidex.
Arimidex?
Arimidex, yeah.
Okay.
And I was wondering what the side effects would be from this, or if there would be any.
Well, there has been a new study showing that the Arimidex may be a better treatment than the tamoxifen. And I believe, although this is a very specific area of women's health that I usually defer to oncologists for most of the specific questions about whether patients should really switch or not. But I have been reading more articles that patients are getting switched. Tamoxifen itself is a SERM, a selective estrogen receptor modulator. I like to think of it as a cousin of the drug raloxifene I was just talking about. But biochemically, they're actually very different, although they do bind in the cells to approximately the same place. And tamoxifen acts like an estrogen on some parts of our body and anti-estrogen on others, so that it is anti-breast cancer in terms of the effects of the breast. And there are women who are using tamoxifen to help prevent ever getting breast cancer. And for any listeners out there interested in that, I usually suggest that either with your physician or go on the web at the National Institute of Health website and calculate out your GAIL scale, that's G-A-I-L, scale risk, and it will give you some information about whether you'd be a candidate for this. But tamoxifen is estrogen-like on other tissues. We're not really sure about the bone. The bone and tamoxifen is a little bit of an open question mark, but some patients in menopause probably don't need to do anything else for their bones if they're on tamoxifen other than getting them checked with a DEXA reading, mm-hmm. the test that actually gives you information about the bone density. But also tamoxifen is very estrogen-like on the lining of the uterus. And that is one of its big side effects, in that 1 in 5 women on tamoxifen will grow polyps of their lining of the uterus. And if not treated and in some other patients, there's a very small but known risk of lining cancer of the uterus as an effect from tamoxifen. So that anybody who has any bleeding or irregular discharge while on the tamoxifen needs to get an ultrasound and possibly a biopsy of the uterus to get that checked out. And the other risks of tamoxifen, pretty much the risks like estrogen, slight increase risk in blood clotting. And we also know that tamoxifen does not prevent hot flashes, and in a small percent of patients, particularly in the early months of taking it, can cause some hot flashes.
Mm-hmm. I had hot flashes with it, but now that I'm on the other drug, I'm having hot flashes again. I'd gotten over them, and then after they took me off the tamoxifen and put me on this Armidex, I'm having hot flashes again.
Yeah, that can happen, and it's a little bit difficult to treat. There aren't a lot of good treatments of hot flashes that don't involve estrogen, but actually some of the SSRIs do work for that, drugs like Prozac and its cousins.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. We had a call who asked her question off the air.
Okay.
And Henry Frain, our operator, took it down, and I will relate it to you as best as I can, and I hope that there's enough information here.
I'll ask you the follow-up questions. You can just fill it in.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go. It's a woman. She is 40.
Okay.
She had a regular mammogram 4 months ago, and since then found a small lump. Now, another mammogram has been done. Her doctor has scheduled a biopsy this week on Thursday, and she hasn't yet talked with her doctor, but wanted to know what it could mean and how often this might turn out to be either positive or negative. And I'm not sure what that means. Could go on to be cancer or could not be cancerous.
Well,
and she's apparently, you know, she's worried. Understandably, she's worried.
Well, a study was done in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at women who participated in mammogram screening programs over a 10-year period of time, and they calculated that approximately one-third of patients over that 10-year period of time would need follow-up studies because of some sort of irregularity on their mammograms. So I try, and I myself probably, like other physicians, don't always get this communicated to my patients. I try to inform the patients that sometimes follow-up studies, either another what they call cone-down view, a more magnified view of a particular area, either an early follow-up in one breast or an early follow-up in both breasts, either a biopsy or an ultrasound. If you put all those things together, about one-third of all women will need something else done. So just the fact that something suspicious is on your mammogram, not necessarily this lady's, I'll get back to her case in a second, but just the fact that something was found on mammogram is extraordinarily common. And of course, it would trigger worry anyway, but most cases does not turn out to be a cancerous condition. Now, mammograms are not completely accurate. There's both what we call false positive and false negatives, and they're indirect evidence of a problem. And the only way to confirm whether there is a problem or not is to biopsy the tissue of concern. And physicians will differ on the type of biopsy, the types of lesions to biopsy. There are some differences, but in general, the mammogram report can help you fine-tune what your radiologist was thinking about your case, so that the mammogram reports tend to be scored on a level of 0 to 5. So if you get a what they call a BIRADS, and it's capital BIRADS, and has initials. If I thought about it long enough, I could spit out what the initials are, but it's a radiological group that came up with this scoring. And a level 0 just means it's incomplete. The patient needed additional evaluation, very often the other views I talked about. If it's a BI-RADS 1, it's supposed to be a completely normal exam. There's a known false positive rate, but they can't see anything on that x-ray, and there's nothing else they recommend. If it's a BI-RADS 5, it's highly suspicious of x-ray patterns that are usually associated with cancer. May not always be, but BI-RADS 5, in my experience, are most often, when biopsied, found to be cancer. Then there's class 2, 3, and 4. Class 2s are where the mammogram itself doesn't look completely normal, but just not enough to pinpoint any particular area or any particular condition. And most patients are told with BI-RADS 2s to just go ahead and have your mammogram done next year. And we see a lot of BI-RADS 2 in patients that are either young, so that their tissue is more dense, or patients that are older but on hormones, so their tissue is more dense. BI-RADS 3s and 4s are a little bit more likely to be associated with a suspicious area, and statistically a little bit more likely that they're going to find something, but still most biopsies in patients that are BI-RADS 3s and 4s are not cancer. So hopefully she can look at her report. Most radiology departments will send the patient a specific letter that will detail a little bit of this information in the letter. Or she could go back to the radiologist and specifically ask them, what do you see, and what, based on what you're seeing here, what's my statistical likelihood of having a cancer? But ultimately, if you've had a biopsy recommended, it's very important, particularly with breast disease, to have that biopsy done. Mm-hmm. Because picked up in the early stages, which cancers picked up on mammogram, 95% of those patients do not die of breast cancer. Their breast cancer may need treatments and a lot of stress, there's no doubt, and a lot of what we call morbidity, but most people do not have mortality from breast cancer because we do pick it up early.
Yeah. Well, it sounds as if what happened was, you know, she had the mammogram, and then one day she gets a call from her doctor's offices, and it's the nurse saying, we want you to come for a biopsy. And that, I'm, you know, if it was me, it would freak me out totally, and I'm sure it would freak out anybody. So I guess she has not had a chance to talk with her doctor. Do you think there's any point in her trying to, between now and the time of the appointment for the biopsy, for her to have a conversation with her doctor?
There's no doubt about it that getting a consultation before she makes that decision to actually have the biopsy will have to occur, and I'm sure it will occur. They probably, somebody has to explain to you what you're doing, and you have to physically, or usually in writing with your signature, agree to the fact that you're going to have a biopsy. And until you have that more detailed conversation, you're right, you're not going to know exactly what's going on. And that detailed conversation probably cannot take place on the phone. And therefore, physicians' offices often sort of walk that tightrope between saying, well, we have a report we want to tell you about, but we can't really tell you about it over the phone, or we want you to come in. And some patients feel very comfortable with less information and just tell me what I need to do. But absolutely, for anybody that gets a phone call saying they need a biopsy, the sooner they can get in for that consultation piece, the better.
Okay. And then again, just to go back to what you said, and the fact that they picked up a lump, that they're concerned enough to want to do a biopsy, does not mean that that's necessarily cancer.
And most aren't. Most biopsies are not cancer.
And then if, God forbid, it was, it sounds like what you're saying is that we're doing better, we're catching it early, and if it's small, the prognosis for treatment is really good.
Absolutely. And not only that, but if it's small, the prognosis for keeping your breast is excellent. And so that's obviously very important, because that means less surgery, and overall that's better for your health and what most women feel comfortable about. We actually, in the United States, do about double the number of biopsies as they do in England, to pick up approximately the same rate of breast cancer, which is kind of interesting. So it is true that our radiologists are very suspicious of even very small areas of concern on the mammogram, but the average American woman feels more comfortable to err on the side of checking out something that might be suspicious. But probably ultimately we want to fine-tune that process a little bit, and we probably could actually ultimately reduce the number of biopsies that we have to take for non-cancerous problems.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit less. The guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School. Once a month on a Monday, she is here on the program to talk about women's health, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, here we have another off-air question. So, again, I hope we have enough detail for me to ask the question. Here we go. It concerns ovarian cysts. A 50-year-old woman was told that she had one and that the test, this is what I've got, the test should be repeated in a month. Is it reasonable to wait a month for another test? And she would just like for you to do a general discussion about ovarian cysts.
Well, ovarian cysts are usually small fluid collections of the ovary, and they usually are picked up either by pelvic examination or pelvic ultrasound, and most often some sort of combination. You go in for your pap smear, you have a pelvic exam, or you had some discomfort, you have a pelvic exam, they feel that one of your ovaries is enlarged, and they do an ultrasound and discover that indeed the enlargement is due to a small fluid collection within the ovary. We used to say that most of those cyst kind of fluid collections were associated only with ovulation and only in women prior to menopause. But it turns out that postmenopause, or if you're very close to this either perimenopause or close to your time of menopause, which the average age of menopause is 51, so a 50-year-old would be either newly in menopause or newly coming to menopause, it turns out that it's not so uncommon to have some of these same fluid collections that are probably associated with some egg development in the ovary, and that often as much will resolve on their own. So that, yes, depending on what the pelvic examination showed, what symptoms she herself was having, and what the ultrasound looked like, it's usually reasonable to wait a month if you're assuming that all the factors in her case showed that it was non-cancerous. Now, as you move forward, if it was a little more suspicious of a cancer, meaning that it was more solid or had some abnormal blood flow on ultrasound, there may be other reasons to be a little more aggressive than a month. But even still, in cases of cancer, we feel that when picked up, the cancer's typically been there for years and years, and that 1 month evaluation process has not ever been shown to adversely affect the outcome.
Okay. Well, again, I hope that is helpful for the two callers. It makes it, if you want to ask your question that way, that's okay. We'll do our best to get your question. It makes it a little bit more difficult. It might be more useful to you if you want to talk with the doctor that way. If she has questions or you have follow-up, you can have the opportunity to do that. However,
we'll be instant messaging, I guess, pretty soon, or text messaging on my phone.
Well, yeah, probably. In any case, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Are there some other things on your list of
Well, I think there's not a lot of time left. I was going to talk about a news report that I saw from Glaxo Pharmaceutical Company. They announced their phase 3 study of their vaccine that they're developing against the human papillomavirus, and they anticipate that they're going to be enrolling in this study fairly quickly, but they anticipate that they would not have a vaccine ready for use until 2008 at the earliest. So it is a long, slow process. I've been involved with actually some earlier studies on this same vaccine and two other vaccine studies. And I'm also involved in a vaccine study that is basically completing their study of young women that have been vaccinated. Now we're moving into they're calling it the mid-adult group, the 24 to 45. And the goal of these vaccines against the human papillomavirus is to prevent cervical cancer. And we know that there are 450,000 women worldwide who die of cervical cancer each year, which is still astounding. And we think that there are 30 different types of human papillomavirus that affect the genital tract. And two of these types, type 6 and 11, seem to be associated with many cases of abnormal pap smear as well as warts of the genital area. And two of these types, the 16 and 18, are associated with many of the precancerous changes, but also most of the cancer. So about 75, maybe even some groups of patients, 80% of all cancers associated with type 16 and 18. So that if you could develop a vaccine to immunize women against these four types of human papillomavirus, your potential to prevent abnormal pap smears and prevent cervical cancer is just incredible. And there's been a lot of excitement about the development of these vaccines. And we know that we want to help prevent these diseases because, number one, we don't always pick up cervical cancer before it develops. And ultimately, it kills 13,000 women in the United States each year. And number two, our current strategies against treating the precancerous stages to prevent them from going on to cancer are very effective in preventing cancer in most of those patients. But unfortunately, it often involves surgery of the cervix, and we've linked that surgery to preterm birth. And a recent study didn't show as much preterm birth as it did show preterm rupture of membranes in women who've had LEAPS before, which is one of the surgeries used to treat precancerous changes of the cervix. So we think that human papillomavirus infection is very prevalent in the United States. There may be 40 million or more Americans who have this infection, and preventing it is very difficult. Condoms don't do a very good job of preventing human papillomavirus infections. And we feel that vaccine studies and eventually widespread vaccination of the population is going to be the ultimate way to prevent most cases of cervical cancer.
All right. Well, there we'll have to leave it because we've come to the end of the time. I want to thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Dr. Suzanne Truppen, she's an obstetrician, gynecologist. She is on the program once a month, always on a Monday, and we talk about women's health. Our program is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Coming up a little bit later today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, writer Rachel Cohen talks about her journey into American history, arts, and letters. She is the author of the book A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists, 1854 to 1967. She says these lives came and went during the fruitful, difficult period that held two related struggles, the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. Celeste Quinn is the host of the show, and she will talk with Rachel Cohen in the 1 o'clock hour. The show otherwise gets underway at noon with the usual mix of news, weather, sports, and other things. Also tonight at 7 o'clock, we'll have live coverage of President Bush's address to the Army War College in Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania. He'll be talking about the June 30th handover of power to the transitional government in Iraq. That's tonight at 7 here on AM 580. We're going to break. We have an update on news and in the markets, so stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau and IFB's AgriVisor Market Advisory Service. AgriVisor offers market information and advice on the web to Illinois and Indiana Farm Bureau members.